I don't like it. He's too good, Father.
Dietrich Zimmer had always thought that a sense of humor was important to the overall well-being of any individual.
You worry too much, Martin. This is all part of a plan I have refined over many years in waiting. Now it can be fulfilled. This plan upon which we have embarked is the most desperate gamble in all of human history, my son. So you should feel that you are part of history. Because whatever the results, the world will be changed forever. Whether we win or lose. And if we win, we will realize the dream of Alexander and Caesar and Hitler. Be sole masters of the planet. Such a prize is worth such a risk.
My mother's programming will not be strong enough to overcome her natural instincts. All her adult life, she has not only been John Rourke's wife, but until the night of the war, been committed to the principles of nonviolence. And you expect her to kill her husband.
Dietrich Zimmer's hands rested on his desktop, and he stood up, then began to walk across the broad expanse of the low-ceilinged room that was his laboratory office. Beyond the blank walls, where no windows could be cut because of the demands of security, there lay one of the most spectacular views on the planet, the Himalayas. This was indeed the eternally snow-covered roof of the world. He was at once its master and its prisoner. With his armies moving across North America and his naval and air forces poised for the death blow against Hawaii and Midway beneath the sea, all that remained to consider was New Germany itself and the comparatively inconsequential civilizations of Europe, Australia, and Lidveldet Island. New Germany would be a formidable opponent, but with the power of the Transglobal Alliance effectively neutralized, New Germany would fall. Unless, of course, the nuclear detonations, which would invariably ensue, did indeed precipitate the final destruction of the planet itself.
You have not read Milton, have you, Martin?
Milton who? You know I don't like to read.
Dietrich Zimmer counted himself a failure in the raising of his son, but soon the process of genetic altering could begin. The remains of Hitler, recovered from deep within the mountain community in what had been upstate New York, were even now being brought to him. Still, Martin would always be a disappointment, but Zimmer loved the boy.
I meant the poet, John Milton. His most notable work is entitled Paradise Lost.
So?
Like Satan, I too would rather rule in hell than serve in heaven, Martin. Do you understand that?
Martin didn't answer, but that was as Dietrich Zimmer had expected.
Martin, consider the following. With the medical technologies that I possess, you and I are essentially immortal. When these bodies, which we wear, begin to decay, they can be replaced by cloned bodies already waiting for us in cryogenic sleep. The electrochemical impulses which inspire our minds with what is called memory and thought are constantly recorded, so even a sudden death will not bring death. The dream of immortality is ours, yet we are not its slaves. Should either of us at some time in the distant future truly tire of life, we can leave it. This is the ultimate freedom, the ultimate power. We will be like the ancient gods, Martin, but unlike them, we will not fade from memory. Shall not perish except by our own hands, by our own wills. This I have given to you, and you doubt that I realize that your mother would almost certainly so resist her programming that she would not kill your father? It was even more obvious to me than it was to you, and I do not share her genes. She will go so far as to attempt the act, and your biological father, John Rourke, will be forced to kill her and thus be destroyed or be forced to submit to me so that I will free her. And his submission will be total, Martin. Total! John Rourke will be the slave of my will, of your will. Think, lad. He will be the visible leader of the Earth until the time is right that he should be replaced by you, son. Trust to my plan.
Dietrich Zimmer returned to his desk as Martin, silently, sullenly, walked from the room. Martin was ill-prepared for greatness, however Dietrich Zimmer had tried to raise the boy. Martin was self-indulgent, petulant, dulled by excess. But that would change too. The Paladin was as magnificent as it was enormous. Sharing the V-Stall fighter's cockpit with Emma Shaw, John Rourke was truly in awe at such a magnificent example of man's domination over nature, as was this undersea vessel they now approached. Larger by far than 20th century aircraft carrier surface ships, its upper deck was of sufficient length that a Concorde, the fastest passenger aircraft of that century, could have landed in perfect safety. But beneath this deck, there were tunnels, themselves the size of World War II carriers, it seemed, the tunnel mouths opening and closing with and against the seas surrounding them, opening for takeoffs and landings of fighter aircraft and larger fighter bombers, then closing again, the water within returned to the sea, becoming safe environments for the boarding and disembarkation of aircraft, servicing maintenance, all the necessary functions. During battle, the elevators within the decks could raise and lower from airlocked chambers below, inserting fresh and already manned aircraft, retrieving damaged aircraft or injured personnel. Refueling during combat was accomplished by remote robotics. The aircraft themselves, such as the V-Stall flown by Emma Shaw, were capable of operating as mini-submersibles or fully combat-worthy fighter planes, their pilots equally at home within the sea or in the air. These submersible carriers and the aircraft which called them home base comprised the most versatile fighting machines ever devised, and they were designed for the maintenance of peace, the prevention of war. And although John Rourke felt in awe of the technology represented here, he felt greater respect for their mission. With such machines, a world could be taken. But that was not their mission. And Dietrich Zimmer and his Nazi followers knew that, which was why Zimmer had opted for the use of nuclear weapons. Otherwise, his forces would not have had a chance. The water rushed over and around the V-Stall's fuselage, the sensation of motion wildly exciting like that of a roller coaster, and John Rourke realized that his hands were clamped to the arms of the co-pilot's seat. For a moment, he could imagine himself careening through the galaxy in some space opera film, but rather than starfields, schools of deep sea life, fish and squid in a wild pageant of color surrounded him.
John, would you like to take the controls for a few seconds? Just to feel that you've done it? It could only be for a few seconds. It flies just like a regular aircraft when the controls are on manual.
Are you sure?
It'll be all right.
John Rourke's hands reached out to the yoke, grasped it, his fingers flexing over it.
Ready, John?
I think so.
On three, it's yours. One, two, three.
There was a sudden power in the yoke, and as Rourke's hands closed more tightly over it, the aircraft's nose dipped slightly. The school of translucent fish, which had already been fleeing the approaching craft, vectoring off in response to his slight course change, swimming madly but effortlessly, it seemed.
Ha-ha! This is wonderful!
Hold her steady, John, just like an aircraft. Don't think water and fish, just heavy air, okay?
Okay.
He felt like a child, or, as best John Rourke could remember being a child, a sense of freedom and wild wonder filling him, like the first time he'd soloed a conventional jet aircraft so many centuries ago.
Magnificent. I envy you getting to do this. I really do.
When there's time, I can get you the instruction you need. With your flying skills, it'd be a snap for you.
I don't know about that, the snap part. Take the controls back before I get us into trouble, Emma.
On three, then. One, two, three.
The power left the yoke beneath John Rourke's hands, and he sagged back into his seat, the smile on his face still something he could feel. James Darkwood waited in the observation deck, his eyes riveted on the fighter squadron homing in on the Paladin's landing bays. And even though he was aboard what was perhaps the most powerful war machine ever on Earth, he felt naked without a sidearm. Nearly as uncomfortable as he did in khakis. He had worked in naval intelligence as a part of Trans-Global Alliance's intelligence for so long that it seemed like forever, and shaking the habit of constantly being on guard, even had it been possible, would not have been prudent. This was his first sea duty in years, and would not last long. He was here for a conference and nothing more. Then he'd get his new orders and return to the trenches. If the Nazis escalated their use of nuclear weapons, the world would be a battlefield sooner than he cared to consider. His illustrious ancestor, Jason Darkwood, had helped to eliminate a nuclear threat over a century ago, John Rourke beside him, the entire Rourke family, too, and, of course, the almost legendary Sebastian, Jason Darkwood's sometimes cryptic black first officer and lifelong best friend. Perhaps it was the fate of the Darkwoods to fight beside the Rourkes. James Darkwood didn't know, but he did know that this would somehow be the fight for the future of the world. He felt that in his bones as a stirring, a shiver along the length of his spine.
Commander!
He hadn't worn the rank for that long, and for a moment Darkwood didn't realize that it was he who was being addressed. After a second, though, he turned around, already seeing the seaman's face reflected in the viewing port.
Yes?
Begging the commander's pardon, but Captain Mallory requests that you join her when she welcomes General Rourke, sir?
Let me tell you, son. If the captain addresses John Rourke as general, she'll be getting off to a start on a sore point. He may be a general, but he prefers doctor, or just John. Dr. Rourke isn't one to stand on ceremony and seems to abhor titles of rank. So give yourself an edge if you get to meet him. Trust me, he won't put you on a report if you call him doctor. But he won't let you in on his good side right away if you call him general.
Aye, sir.
I'll be along directly, sailor.
Aye, sir.
Darkwood turned back toward the sea. This was a beautiful planet, and there was a strong chance that it would die.
Shit.
Sarah Rourke's eyes squinted shut against the brightness of the light, and her stomach felt uneasy with the fresh surge of motion. Where she was made absolutely no sense at all. She'd seen clouds and water and faces peering down on her with great feeling, but she was lost, and she was confused beyond any similar feeling she had ever had before. Was she almost Sarah, or was she Sarah Rourke? Inside her, like something deep and dark and hidden, there was a purpose. And she knew the purpose. For some reason, John had shot in the very moments after she'd born their third child, a son. She remembered the fire and the shooting, and she remembered a face peering down at her, and the face was vivid. It was John's face, but somehow different, in a way she had never seen his face before. There was a momentary flash from the muzzle of his gun, and everything after that was gone until she awakened. Were these her memories, or memories of the real Sarah Rourke? Were they one and the same? If she were almost Sarah, she shared each and every one of the real Sarah's memories, because she was as much the real Sarah as the real Sarah. If she was almost Sarah, her body was genetically identical to that of the original because she was a clone. If she was almost Sarah, her mind bore the same memories. The brain, after all, was an organ like any other, its functions vastly more sophisticated in their way. And the input to the brain was what made memory, what determined judgment. And the input to her brain was that of Sarah Rourke. Whether she was the real Sarah or only almost Sarah, she was Sarah. And John had shot Sarah in the head, all but killing her. For some reason, she thought the reason for his uncharacteristically horrible deed was his wild passion for Natalia. But it was hard to imagine Natalia condoning such a thing, nearly as hard to imagine as John doing it. But John had done it. She learned later from Dr. Zimmer, who had saved her life through his miraculous surgical techniques, that John had attempted to kill the original Martin, her son and John's, whom Zimmer had raised as his own child. It was odd to imagine Zimmer, a Nazi, being capable of such kindness. It barely made any sense at all. She puzzled over that as she was wheeled along the hospital corridor. But unlike those in any hospital she had ever seen, the corridor walls were of steel, gleaming and bright, more like an operating theater might be than any ordinary corridor. But John had killed one of Martin's clones. That was bad enough. Dr. Zimmer said that Martin had uncovered what had been done to her, and by whom. Perhaps John had been seized by some momentary madness, Dr. Zimmer explained. Whatever the reason, killing the clone of Martin was an attempt to disguise the truth, which, of course, was also terribly uncharacteristic of John. To John, truth was the greatest passion, and from that passion sprang every other passion of his life. The most telling of Dr. Zimmer's arguments was when he admitted to her who he was.
I was the man responsible for the attack on the hospital. It was a murder raid, of course, the intent to kill your husband. But after your husband shot you, he in turn was critically injured by one of my men. I found this baby, whom I named Martin, your baby. You will hear many evil things of me in the world outside, Sarah, and they will almost all be true.
I am the Nazi leader. I plan for war. I intend to achieve world domination or perish in the attempt.
Perhaps my motivations for saving your baby and eventually restoring you were the inverse of the terrible deed committed by your husband, John Rourke. There is a saying, which I'm sure you know. There is a little bad in the best of us, and a little good in the worst of us. Your life and the life of your son, Martin, are my little good, as it were. I feel, at least, that my little good was of greater import than anything I have done that is evil. So perhaps someday, if you view my record as a man, you will find the same compassion for me in your heart which I found for you in mine.
These memories were real, but were they hers or implanted into Almost Sarah? Did that make a difference? She remembered John shooting her. That was undeniable. And she had nearly as concrete proof of his killing of the man he'd thought was their son, Martin. If he did not deny killing Martin's clone, then it was certain that his intent was to kill Martin, and just as certain that he would attempt to do so again. He could not be allowed to do that. There was only one way to assure that he did not kill their son, his sworn enemy, and that was to kill John. Her life was in ruins, but with John dead, perhaps Martin could be made to feel safe in the world, away from Dr. Zimmer's control, so that he would come away with her, learn that the Nazi ideology, which Dietrich Zimmer freely admitted teaching Martin, was wrong. Perhaps Martin, through his knowledge of both sides of the conflict, could bring about peace, allaying the relentless momentum toward war. It would be a war from which the human race might never recover. And that might only be possible if she killed her husband. Her head ached with a terrible fury, and she felt tears welling up in her eyes. As she closed her eyes, she saw John's face as he stood over her, gun in hand, aimed at her head.
I am all right, really.
Wolfgang Mann eased himself into a chair to John Rourke's immediate right. John clapped him on the shoulder, nodding approvingly. Emma Shaw felt very much like a little mouse who had scurried out of her hole in the baseboard and suddenly found herself transported through some freak of time and nature to the most momentous moment in history. Everyone was here. Aside from Captain Mallory, commanding the Paladin, there was Admiral Thelma Hayes, commander of United States Forces, and only hours ago elevated to Supreme Commander Transglobal Alliance. There was Field Marshal Heinrich M.C. Krauss, commander of the forces of New Germany, Marine Corps Lieutenant General Thomas Wilson, Chief of Allied Commando Operations, Dr. Thorn Rolvag, the scientist who claimed that the world might end, James Darkwood, whose reputation as the most intrepid agent in Allied intelligence must have preceded him everywhere, merely surveyed the faces at the table. His own face seemed identical with that of his illustrious ancestor, Jason Darkwood, whose picture hung in the main entrance of the Naval Academy at Midwake, alongside that of John Paul Jones. James Darkwood looked incredibly handsome, without being pretty, with his wavy hair, the well-defined bone structure, and the intensity of his eyes. It wasn't uncommon to see a young female midshipman standing in front of Jason Darkwood's picture there at the Academy, the thoughts running through her mind, obvious. And the entire Rourke family, except for John's wife Sarah, was present as well. Michael, Annie, Paul, and Major Natalia Temerovna. Why she herself, Emma Shaw, was here was a mystery. She had nowhere near the rank required. As if her senses were not sufficiently reeling, only moments before entering the Paladin's conference center, she received a message that her father, Tim Shaw, had been injured in battle with terrorists in Hawaii, but had made it to help, was now hospitalized, and expected to fully recover. A second message came seconds after the first from her brother Ed, confirming that their father was banged up but expected to be back to duty within a couple of days. There was also a request.
When you get the chance, Emma, try to talk some sense into him, huh? He could have had the SWAT team with him, but he went after this Nazi asshole all alone and almost bought the farm. But he did nail the guy, and then he got the three triggermen that were there to back the guy up.
Emma was looking to stand by a bulkhead somewhere out of the way. There were electronic name locators at each chair along all sides of the table, and hers was to the left of John Rourke. Was she officially recognized as his woman, a part of the family? If that was the only reason she was here, she was not happy for it, although being John's woman was her ultimate joy, or would be. But she was her own person. John knew that, respected that. Emma Shaw would wait and see. Admiral Hayes called the conference to order.
Several potentially cataclysmic events confront us, and they are all interlinked. Their outcome could affect the future of life on this planet. General Wilson, give us an update.
Yes, ma'am.
General Wilson stood. He was a small man, just a hair under Emma's own height, but he was burly-chested, powerfully built.
We confront several rather disturbing possibilities. In order of recurrence, the allies of our Nazi enemies, Eden, have perfected several variants of deadly biological agents. Thanks to Commander Shaw, much of the bio threat has been, at least temporarily, neutralized with the destruction of Eden City Plant 234. This only made possible by the intelligence work of Commander Darkwood and his associate from New Germany, and the work of many others who shall remain unsung, I know. Given time, however, like all bad pennies, the Eden bio effort will resurface and come back to haunt us. The bio effort's destruction will only slow down the timetable for one of the crises facing us. Next came the discovery by Dr. Rolvag, which has been confirmed by scientists all over the free world, that there is a volcanic fissure opening in the ocean beneath us, spreading inexorably, it seems, toward the Pacific coast of North America. It is Dr. Rolvag's considered opinion, on which he will soon elaborate, that this fissure can only be stopped, and then it's only a gamble, not a certainty, by the employment of a large number of nuclear weapons, their explosive force to close the fissure. Thirdly, is the immediate nuclear threat posed by the detonation by airburst of a tactical thermonuclear device. This escalates the as-yet-undeclared war by higher stakes than we would have thought possible less than just 24 hours ago. And I believe Dr. Rourke has some news that is equally alarming and perfect.
Paul and I discovered something quite alarming just prior to the death of Wolfgang Mann.
John went on, looking at Wolfgang Mann as the General Oberst stared in amazement at John.
Relax, old friend. The man who died was almost Wolfgang Mann. He was a clone, a nearly perfect duplicate.
A clone?
Yes, Dr. Rovach. Almost perfect, and I suspect a pre-production model, as it were, somewhere along the prototype chain. Because Dr. Zimmer arranged things so that we would realize the counterfeit Wolfgang Mann was just that, counterfeit. I have substantial reason to believe that Dr. Zimmer has duplicated not only my entire family, but more importantly to the general interest of the war effort, himself, and the man he calls his son, Martin Zimmer, the leader of Eden. I further have reason to believe that Dr. Zimmer has perfected the means by which to effectively record the electromagnetic impulses of the brain, record thought and memory, then download that data into a recipient, a clone. Zimmer has essentially made himself immortal, unkillable. Cloning, as we know, is based on the theory and practice that each cell of a living organism contains the entire genetic fingerprint. A cell from a finger, or almost anywhere in the body, for example, if grown under appropriate laboratory conditions into an entire organism, could reproduce the host in complete detail. In my day, it was done with frogs and organisms less complicated than man, but was theoretically possible. In fact, the subject of some excellent science fiction. I believe that Dr. Zimmer has perfected this process. Considering his skills, considering the time elapsed since my day in this, and the enormous medical and scientific strides taken, it's hardly out of the question at all. At the least, my family faces a personal crisis. In all likelihood, Zimmer and his self-styled son have placed themselves in a position where they will effectively never die. In a worst-case scenario, Zimmer might well have battalions of fighting men who were the subject of specific genetic engineering, perfect warriors, each identical to the next and none indispensable, because each could be replaced with his own carbon copy.
Carbon?
An ancient means by which copies were made, a duplicate, identical in virtually all respects to the original.
What you're proposing would alter the course of warfare for all time.
Indeed. With his latest scientific weapon, if Zimmer wished, he could mount a war which destroyed the planet to the point where life could not be sustained. then through cryogenic sleep, which we all know, my family especially so, and his cloning process, he could awaken in some distant future and go on forever, merely giving armies time to commence growing 2 decades before his own awakening. He would win, ladies and gentlemen. Zimmer would realize the dream of every conqueror since the dawn of time. He would rule the world and stay around forever to run it, never having to leave it. When one body became worn or diseased, he'd merely download his latest recording from the brain into a waiting body kept in some type of stasis, and in the most literal sense, be born again.
You're thinking that's what's happened to Sarah, aren't you? That she's been cloned?
The small bar in the officer's mess was more elaborate than some of its onshore counterparts, where Emma Shaw had shared a drink with a man, but no man like this. John Thomas Rourke was as much the stuff of preposterous tall tales and fact-based legend as Kit Carson, Wild Bill Hickok, or Buffalo Bill. As much the heroic historical figure as George Washington, Daniel Boone, or Teddy Roosevelt. When he didn't answer her question about Sarah's being cloned, Emma Shaw tapped him on the shoulder, and he turned and looked at her.
Don't you?
Yeah.
Isn't there some way you can tell?
Yeah. Well, at least I think so.
How could you tell?
Very simply, really. If she's Sarah, regardless of any programming that Dietrich Zimmer might have inflicted upon her, she won't kill me. If she's a clone, she'll possibly kill me. Either way, she'll try. Zimmer would not have let us get to her so easily otherwise.
Easily?
Emma, he's probably got a half dozen of each of us. Sarah, me, Annie and Paul, Michael and Natalia, and Wolfgang. If you'd been with us in cryogenic sleep in New Germany, he'd have a few spares of you lying around too. You can trust me on that. I'm learning how the man thinks, and he thinks very well, however twisted his purposes. Either way, though, I suspect he's counting on the fact that Sarah or her clone won't succeed, but that I'll be convinced enough that she is Sarah that I'll come to him for a deal.
Would you?
Yeah, go to him, I mean. What I said to you earlier about loving you, I meant that. And whoever the real Sarah is, she'll leave me. You see, I'm convinced that the real Wolfgang Mann is the Wolfgang Mann with us. I had him scanned. There aren't any microprocessors in his head, or at least nothing we can detect. The same for Sarah. And Wolf is too much like Wolf to be anyone else but who he is. It's a gut-level feeling that I can't really explain. You'll forgive my lapse from logic.
Forgiven.
Thank you. But there is some logic at work. In order to reinforce the idea that Sarah is Sarah, so I'll trust her and walk into Zimmer's trap. Zimmer gave us the real Wolfgang. I think the assumption is valid. And Sarah might really be Sarah, or might not. Either way, when she attempts to kill me, and hopefully fails, I'll have no choice but to go to the source of her programming. He'll try to take me, download my mind into one of those clones, at the same time programming the clone to behave with a certain set of responses which will make the clone obey Zimmer's will. Then kill me, of course.
Oh, of course. Then what?
Well, I'd be dead. And he'd have the fake John Rourke run the world for him for a time, I'd suspect. Only logical if one thinks like Dietrich Zimmer. But you have to admit, it's an interesting hypothesis. Would I still be me, only different, with a duplicate body and all of my own memories and thoughts and ideas, just a few extra added? And if one discounts the extras, would I be me, truly me? Would Zimmer undo his own plans by recreating me?
You lost me somewhere in metaphysics.
Anyway, it's not all that into metaphysics. It's merely advanced biology. I had a friend in the days before the night of the war who spoke about cloning sometimes. He was convinced that once we could find a way of dealing with the morality and dealing with the mechanics of recording the brain, and any sort of taped recording is nothing more than the capturing of electromagnetic impulses, which is what the brain runs on, of course, that cloning would eventually bring man immortality. He was right. My friend, that is.
But what about the clones? Don't they have rights as people instead of spare parts?
If the brain is allowed to grow in a stimulation vacuum, it's rather like a battery fresh from the factory. The old kind of storage battery.
I know what you mean about the batteries.
Fine. Now,
The battery doesn't really do anything, nor does it have any capabilities, not even potential energy, until it's charged. Once it's charged, then it's capable of a wide range of activities, depending on how it's employed, for good or bad.
But there's still people.
Well, exactly, but Zimmer doesn't have to worry about questions like, what's moral, what's immoral, because he's amoral. And he has the technology to do what he wants, so he has clones.
And you think that no matter how he programmed the real Sarah, he couldn't overcome her natural, better instincts?
No, not really. Now, Sarah's killed in self-defense, so I imagine that Zimmer would have worked up some sort of scenario where I'm out to kill Martin, our son, something like that, giving Sarah a morally acceptable reason to kill in defense of her child. She'd have to be convinced that somehow I slipped a trolley.
Slipped a trolley?
That's an old expression. That I wasn't playing with a full deck, had a few screws loose, like that.
Right.
Anyway, God only knows what Zimmer would have told her. But it would have to be something he planted in her as a memory, not just a story, or so something wrapped around real events, not faked ones, just seen from a different point of view. He could have dragged Natalia into it, anything. Anyway, the thing about the real Sarah, and maybe a clone too, is that I can read her moods, her body language well enough, that I'll have a little advanced warning and be able to react in time to stop her, whether she's really Sarah or the clone, who in a way is really Sarah too. I mean, if there's a soul...
Metaphysics.
Right, right. Then it would stand to reason that the soul would accompany intellectual awareness. So maybe both people would be Sarah.
One soul in two bodies.
That's an odd idea. Either that or the clone wouldn't have a soul. Or the clone would have a different soul. But then where did it come from? Where did it enter the body? In the petri dish, as it were? And there's lots of tough questions, both philosophically and morally, represented by the mere concept of cloning. And if you add the idea that a clone would be kept as a non-sentient spare parts bank, well, then there's really a moral dilemma. And there's another interesting idea. What if two distinctly separate but perfectly identical beings, having the same cognitive experiences, etc., were able to function as one? Did they ever do a remake of the Corsican Brothers? It was an old film with Douglas Fairbanks Jr., I think.
I don't think so, but I know the story. You mean like that, in the movie?
Well, not quite, but a shared consciousness. If there's truth to the idea of mental telepathy and similar phenomena, which I know for a fact there is since my daughter seems to have cornered the market on it, that it would only make sense that two identical beings would be able to communicate in such a manner. And that is how we should be able to defeat Dietrich Zimmer with any luck.
You've lost me completely.
Let's say that Dietrich Zimmer and I have one special thing in common. We both believe that it pays to plan ahead. Whatever he'd call it, however he'd phrase it, the idea is the same. Whether I have the real Sarah or a clone, there's another Sarah available to him, up and running, fully programmed, all dressed and ready, just in case. Like carrying spare magazines for a pistol, a spare flint for a lighter. Be ready for whatever contingency arrives by anticipating it in such a fashion that an appropriate response can be instantaneous. Good. That's common sense. He has common sense. No morality, no decency, but good common sense. And so do I.
So you could use Sarah or her clone as a telepathic link to Sarah or her clone or another clone? If it wasn't Sarah in the first place or Sarah were...
Dead. Yes. Communicate with that almost Sarah, and reason with her. Tell her the truth about whatever lies she's been fed and gain her help from inside against Dietrich Zimmer. You see, to kill Zimmer, which I must do, the only way is to kill the clones.
Oh, God. Just taking innocent lives like that?
I don't see any choice. God help us. And not just his, but...
You couldn't, John. I know you.
I may have to kill the clones of Sarah and the children and Natalia... And even myself. Without the cloned recipient, even if Zimmer were to be able to download a recording of the genuine article's mine, he wouldn't fool anyone. And without the recordings, the clones would be fully grown infants. I don't know.
Oh, John.
But the only way to stop Dietrich Zimmer from eventually ruling the world and employing his Nazi concepts of racial purity and totalitarianism, evil winning, the only way to prevent that is to destroy the original, the clones, the recordings of the mind. For that, I'll need help inside. I'll go to him. Bring the real Sarah or her clone, whoever she is, making him think that despite my best efforts, he's won. Then get him. That's why I should have told you.
I don't understand, John.
Well, it wasn't fair to tell you that I love you. Because if everything worked out so that I survived, then fine. I could have told you then. But there's a solid chance that I'll die. And I mean, really die. I could, taking the clones of myself with me. They have to be destroyed if there's any chance that Zimmer could triumph. And I'd have to go. But with me dead, he could clone away to his heart's content, and he wouldn't have my mind. He wouldn't have me. He wouldn't be able to bring about what I'm sure he's planning. That's the trouble with making people more important than they really are. All I ever wanted to do was ensure the safety of my family. I had no aspirations toward acclaim, statues like that god-awful thing on the top of the retreat back in what used to be Georgia and is so now vilely called Eden. There's nothing special about me, and there never was. I just happened to be in the wrong place at the right time. And because of that, people think I'm something.
Just a second. Just one damn minute, John Rourke. You are special, damn it. You're the bravest, the best.
Come on, huh? I thought you really understood who I am. And
I do. You're the one who doesn't, John. I'm no student of history, but I know enough about it to know that in the last half of the 20th century, if there were real heroes, nobody ever learned about them. And there had to be firemen and policemen and teachers and soldiers and men and women who did what they had to do, whatever the cost to themselves. But it was an age when everyone with any power in the media, the dissemination of information, pushed the idea of collectivism, denied that individualism was anything at all, even existed. And if you tell me that you're not a hero, John Rourke, then I'll tell you that you're full of shit. Because you'd be believing the crap. They've started to push it again today, for God's sakes, that individual effort doesn't count, but collective effort does. My father is a prime example. He just nearly went out and got himself killed doing something by himself, and he's going to do it again. And I'm not going to try and stop him. My brother wants me to. Eddie keeps telling me, gotta get the old man out of thinking he's a frickin' one-man army, and shit like that. Nuts to that! Things don't have to be decided by committee as long as there's a human brain around. And individualism isn't only the basis for all genuine achievement. It's the damn basis for all thought! Don't tell me you aren't a hero, John. The world needs heroes like you, because you're real. And if you can't look at what you've done in your life with any degree of objectivity, I can. Twice, not just once, you almost single-handedly saved all humanity from totalitarianism. You survived the end of the world twice! That damn statue of you on top of your mountain back in Georgia, John, whether you like it or not, whether it embarrasses you or not, you really did that. You shot down the last enemy helicopter with a damn 45 automatic. And the American flag was flying in the breeze behind you because you put it there. Because a friend of yours, a man who was another hero, died trying to do the same damn thing 1,000 miles away when you destroyed the enemy's chance of surviving the fire in the atmosphere. Your history, a living fucking history, John. When you touch me, I have a hard time not fainting. And I'm not the damn fainting type, John. Grow up, huh? Accept yourself for what you are and realize what you mean to others. If you go and get yourself dead, I'll be a fucking widow before I've even been... before I've even been fucked, damn it! I love you, and so does your family, and you can't just go off!
There's more than an hour before the briefing resumes. I can't agree with your exalted opinion of me, however flattering it would be. But I see a point you made.
Which one?
About becoming a widow before you've ever been...
fucked?
Yeah.
And?
Let's correct that situation, Emma.
But what about...
If I were a hero, I'd have a good answer for everything, wouldn't I? If I were a hero, I wouldn't...
Oh, yes, you would, John Rourke.
I love you. I've said that to 3 women in my life in the way I mean it now. To Sarah, to Natalia, but never to either of them in the way I'm saying it to you. I love you, Emma Shaw.
Then let's do. My cabin or yours.
Rather stuffy fellow that I am right now, I think I'd be perfectly willing to do it right here.
I'm yours. I always have been.
John Rourke leaned toward her from his bar stool, and she felt she would melt. It had never been like this, making love. The touching of two bodies, hands against parts of the flesh where hands except one's own never touched. It was feeling, in its most literal and at once figurative sense. His fingertips caressed her breasts, his lips her nipples. His body enveloping her own, invading her, bending her to his will in a way she had never known before.
I love you.
And I love you. It's funny, but I think I've loved you since the first moment I saw you. But you were married, and...
I know. Be quiet and kiss me.
There had never been fulfillment like this, so deep, so powerful. And fulfillment was merely a thought. His body so wonderfully laboring above her, making her body move in rhythm to his. The roughness of his skin, the force of him made her pulse, made her body vibrate uncontrollably. She had lost control, and she had wanted to lose control all of her life, but one could not give up control. It had to be taken, then surrendered, because there was no choice to do otherwise.
You will marry me?
Yes.
Do you love me?
Like I've never loved.
His body seemed to devour her, and his eyes consumed her when she could keep her eyes open. Sarah Rourke opened her eyes, but Wolfgang Mann was only a dream. She had already determined that if, for some reason, he couldn't, because he was still technically... But as he undressed her, Emma Shaw abandoned any worries.
Oh, John.
Be quiet.
She obeyed, but that was what she wanted to do. Her jacket he placed neatly over the back of the chair near the foot of her bed.
You'll be needing this in a little while.
She only nodded, tempted to speak so that he could tell her once again to be quiet. His hands moved to the zipper of her skirt, zipped it down. She moved her hips. The skirt fell around her ankles. He touched her waist, and she moved her feet, and he picked up her skirt, setting it neatly over the chair back. There was this silly little tie at the collar of her shirt, and he undid it, didn't remove it. His fingers moved against the buttons of her shirt, and Emma Shaw thought that she would scream. She raised her hands in front of her, and he unbuttoned her cuffs, and she almost died. He slipped her shirt from her shoulders, down along her arms, and held her against him. His fingers undid the hook and eye clasps at the back of her bra, and she bent her shoulders forward, and it fell away, the straps caught in the crooks of her elbows. His hands moved along the bare curve of her back, into her panties, thumbing them down over her hips. She moved her legs, and they fell. She still wore stockings, and her panties were down around her ankles, and her arms were caught up in the straps of her bra, and she wanted to be his more than anything she had ever wanted in her life. Without being asked, she reached to the bottom of his sweater and pulled it up. He bent forward, and she pulled it over his head, throwing it down to the deck. Inside the waistband of his trousers, one on either side of his waist, were two pistols, worn without holsters. He took a step back, removed them, set them on the deck at the right side of the bed, then touched her again, behind her now.
Oh.
Emma Shaw closed her eyes, feeling his mouth as it moved along the curve of her throat to her shoulder, his fingertips touching nipples that only a moment earlier had been pressed against the roughness of his sweater.
Tell me to be quiet, John.
Be quiet, baby.
Oh, yes!
She opened her eyes, her hands starting to undo the garrison-width belt at his waist. Men hid behind these things, she reasoned. The buckles enormous, the leather thick and heavy. She started to pull it out of the trouser loops, realized she didn't have to, and started to feel for a zipper. There was none, only buttons. And she undid those, starting at the top one, working her way down lower than she needed to, feeling the swelling of him with the knuckles of her fingers.
Oh, my God! Oh.
John Rourke looked down at her face, her eyes closed. In a fraction of a second, he would enter her. Deep inside him, he realized that what he was doing was right for everyone. And he did. They were not late for the meeting, and planning ahead had nothing to do with it. Their arrival time mere chance, John Rorick walked into the conference suite, Emma Shaw at his side, on time to the second, for the second session of the meeting to start, according to the black-faced Rolex on his wrist. They sat down, John Rorick holding Emma's chair for her.
Our first order of business in this second session is Dr. Rolvag's summary of the crisis concerning the vent.
Thorn Rolvag stood up, walking toward the far wall, a remote video control clutched in both hands. Rourke could see the man's fingers playing the device's buttons like the fingers of a musician over some well-loved instrument. The size of modern video screens still amazed John Rourke. Utilizing a liquid crystal technology, they could cover an entire wall, picture reproduction perfect in its clarity. The pictures began, very well-resolved underwater video of the vent beneath the Pacific, which was the cause of such great concern. Volcanic lava showed, the yellow-edged redness gleaming like some forbidding view of hell itself. A scale appeared at the bottom of the screen, as a size measure. The width of the vent seemed nearly a quarter mile.
There, ladies and gentlemen, is what might well be the scar from which our planet will not heal. The surface scratch which reveals the horrible illness within. Without closing this vent, and this video is quite recent, only a few hours old, I feel that our planet is doomed. The problem is not controversial. Only my projected solution to it, namely the use of nuclear weapons to reroute the vent, dissipating the force of the volcanic flow. But whatever the remedy, without remedy, this vent will relatively soon reach the easternmost edge of the Pacific Plate and strike the westernmost edge of the North American Continental Plate, precisely where, during the night of the war, the shock waves from the bombing caused the cataclysmic rupturing of the San Andreas Fault and other tributary fault lines, precipitating the collapse of the easternmost edges of the Pacific Plate into the sea. As you may recall from history books, and as the Rourke family doubtless recalls from experience, the resultant cataclysm caused everything to the west of the San Andreas to collapse into the sea. How many millions of persons were killed, we will never know. But the cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco and everything above them and below them and in between them ceased to exist in a matter of minutes. The resultant tidal surge swamped almost all of the Hawaiian Islands landmass, the coast of Alaska, etc. This disaster, which awaits us if it cannot be prevented, would make all of what has gone before pale by comparison. As you no doubt know, but I must emphasize again, what could very well happen is the linking of all the jewels in the Ring of Fire, which surrounds the Pacific Basin. In other words, the vent would slam against the North American plate and split. In itself, that might seem desirable, because its energy would be dissipated. However, that energy would follow along the path of least resistance, as energy does, unless forced to do otherwise. It would follow the plate boundary, activating volcanic activity to the north and to the south, gathering momentum and energy as it moved, fed by the volcanic areas which it touched. Soon, ladies and gentlemen, very soon, the vent would effectively encircle the entire Pacific Basin. Once the encirclement was complete, the eruptive force would be of such strength that an event unlike any other, perhaps in history of the solar system, would occur. The eruptive force would blow out the Pacific Basin. Then, one of two events would occur, and there is no way to tell which. Either the entire planet would implode, or the planet would be launched out of orbit. I lean toward the second theory. As a scientist, I find it ironic that if we cannot prevent the vent from reaching the North American plate, I'll never know which theory was correct. In the instant that the Ring of Fire is completed, the explosion of the Pacific Basin will begin. Any life surviving the rain of volcanic ash, the darkness which will by then have consumed the planet, will be instantly destroyed. So neither I nor any of my colleagues will ever know whether the planet will cease to exist as anything but gigantic pieces of rocky debris in an orbit once held by a planet, or become a dead nomad ejected from the solar system into space. Or the planet might be caught in the gravitational field of the sun and drawn into it.
Dr. Rovog, your proposal is to utilize nuclear warheads as strategically placed charges with which we'll divert the vent, dissipate its energy.
Yes, Dr. Rourke. Along the lines of the theory you proposed shortly after the eruption of Kilauea, we can create a system of canals, or channels, as it were, thus dissipating the force of lateral movement within the vent, blowing off energy into these canals. Harmlessly, essentially, in the hope that the vent will lose sufficient force and stop of its own accord. That is, as far as I can see, our only hope. Other scientists agree that ideally we should discover some means of relieving the volcanic pressure. It's my methodology which scares them, and in truth, I can't say that I blame them.
Why does it scare them, as you say, Doctor?
For the simple reason that nuclear detonations are what probably brought about this crisis in the first place. The Earth is looked at by most of us as a giant object that we can abuse however we like. And I'm not talking about the ecosystem here. Let's take an example that everyone should readily see. In the Lidveldid Island of my ancestors, policemen commonly carried swords as a badge of office. But my ancestor, Bjorn Rolvag, preferred a staff. His staff, my family still possesses it, passed on through the intervening generations, was made for him by a retired scientist.
Old John, the sword maker.
Yes, the same man who made the knife you carry, as I understand.
Like your forefather, old John was a fine man, Doctor.
Thank you, sir. The staff was designed to be used for every conceivable function for which a staff might be needed, as a weapon, a climbing assist, whatever. The staff looks as perfect today as it did in Bjorn Rolvag's day. Because it was cared for properly and only used, not abused. If this mighty ship, the Paladin, had existed in Bjorn Rolvag's day, and he had set about beating at its hull with the staff, he would doubtless have done some minor damage to the hull of the Paladin, but in the process would have mutilated his staff. Rather than using the geology of the planet, we have abused it, and perhaps beyond any hope of repair. Any object, if it is constantly abused, will eventually deteriorate. Nothing except perhaps our own concept of the divine, and for those of us lucky enough, love lasts forever. This may be the end of the species, which must come someday, for sure. But I feel that the impact, the repeated battering of the multi-megaton thermonuclear devices used over 6 centuries ago, is bringing about this termination prematurely. The evidence is overwhelming that the destruction of what was the west coast of the United States was brought about by the impacts of the bombs and missiles. The fault line created within the Gulf of Mexico and extending outward into what was called the Bermuda Triangle, the fault which shortly after the night of the war precipitated the cataclysmic earthquake which collapsed peninsular Florida, destroying it utterly. This was clearly precipitated by the pounding of the nuclear weapons against the Earth's mantle. You'll notice, if you study the history of the thing, that Florida's collapse occurred several weeks after the night of the war. Archives from the Chinese Second City indicate that there were cataclysmic earthquakes over the period of time immediately following the night of the war, and even in the 5 centuries between the Great Conflagration and the return of the Eden Project, earth tremors nearly destroyed the Second City, the civilization at New Germany in South America, etc. Lidveldid Island was itself nearly destroyed. The Hecla community devoured only later to be rebuilt. This latter by volcanism on an unprecedented scale. This is all a pattern which has been developing for centuries, thanks to the folly of mankind.
The folly of mankind in the days following World War II isn't in dispute, Doctor. And it wasn't confined to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. What was lacking was the resoluteness to risk all for what was right. On the global level, this translated into the superpowers feigning at one another, playing a game of death. One night, the game got out of hand. The night of the war was the result. It was essentially inevitable, given the nature of mankind. Not that there'd be warfare, but that something would go wrong, resulting in catastrophe.
And by that, I don't mean that we as a species are evil or stupid. Far from it. Philosophy may seem out of place here, but I tend to think that there's never been a better time for it. Man desires peace, basically. To be left alone, to live out his days in the bosom of his family and friends, as it were. Normal man. But there have always been those for whom the pursuit and capture of power was the reason for living. For some of those others, the pursuit, however vigorous, was, if not to the benefit of mankind, not overwhelmingly to its detriment. Many of these men achieved what we call greatness. A far smaller percentage achieved infamy. Life was always precious, but to an increasingly great number of people in the 20th century, especially those living beneath the umbrella of Western civilization, as it was so euphemistically called, the desire for continued existence overwhelmed all other motives. If there was a chance to survive while hiding from what was wrong, take it. Oh, we took that chance as a species. In the closing decades of the 20th century, ladies and gentlemen, there was a virtual litany of abominations. From the close of World War II onward, evidence strongly suggested that the United States abandoned some of its POWs and MIAs because of political expediency. This was unconscionable. Totalitarian regimes flourished, making the lives of all whom they controlled hell on earth. And we, as Americans or British or any of the other major Western powers, let those regimes essentially do what they wanted so long as we were not affected. The torturing of political prisoners by foreign powers, the erosion of order in public education giving rise to heightened juvenile delinquency, the proliferation of dangerous drugs under the umbrellas of legal loopholes and uncaring citizens, the sweeping horror and incalculable cost in human suffering brought about by pernicious disease such as AIDS, racism, sexism, things that by right should have died of their own weight or been brought to book by the righteous, were allowed to spread, to continue, to entrench themselves in society because society was too apathetic. We have a choice now. We can either summon up the courage we need as a species in order to meet the crisis at hand, or we can die. Therefore, if Dr. Rolvag's solution seems only to be the lesser of two evils, that'll be nothing new. That's how we elected presidents for years, after all, and not always choosing the lesser of two evils at all. We have a clear-cut choice presented to us. Either take a wild gamble, which may result in our death as a species or our survival as a species, or don't gamble. Just wait and die. What real choice is there if we are to call ourselves human beings?
Wolfgang Mann sat down with a drink in his hand, his complexion pale and his carriage a little wobbly. But he had been ill, and was still, it seemed, not fully recovered from his ordeal. But John Rourke was still confident that this man was indeed Wolfgang Mann. The Paladin's officer's mess was essentially deserted, the ship on a modified alert status, and few personnel having the luxury of not needing to be present at a duty station or sleeping. Emma was sleeping. Their cabins had adjoining doors, and he could come to her, she had told him, asked him. The meeting had ended for the day, to be resumed in the morning. John Rourke, too, was tired, needing sleep. But some things took precedence over sleep. Nothing had yet been resolved at the meeting concerning the war strategy and the strategy for fighting the growing volcanic vent beneath the Pacific. But something would be resolved at the meeting scheduled for early the next morning, or John Rourke would stop wasting time with meetings. The thing which had to be resolved now could not wait even until tomorrow. He had seen Sarah. She slept soundly, sedated slightly. By tomorrow she would be fully awake, fully restored, and their marriage, which had lasted more than 6 centuries, would be ended. That was certain. And so was the answer to the question which he was about to ask Generaloberst Wolfgang Mann.
Are you in love with Sarah?
John, it is not...
Please speak frankly, Wolf.
I cannot, because you are my friend, and friendship is something too precious.
But you have no choice but to be honest with me, because you are my friend.
Yes, to both. I am sorry, John. I did not mean for it to happen.
I know that, old friend. Nor did Sarah. I would assume you agree that she is in love with you as well?
She has never...
I would never have thought any different of either of you, Wolf.
I, on the other hand, realized some time ago that Sarah's and my marriage was ended. It was when I caused the death of Martin, or Martin's clone. He was still our flesh, hers and mine, whether clone or the original. Before the night of the war, our marriage was collapsing from its own weight. The war itself merely postponed what was inevitable. Had everything worked out after the defeat of our old enemy, after she and I set up the hospital clinic at what's now Eden City, well, perhaps we could have immersed ourselves in the rebuilding of the world to the point where we could have coexisted and stayed married. Happiness be damned. I still love her, and I know she loves me. But we were never friends. You know what I mean, Wolf?
Yes, and I feel for you. My late wife was my best friend, and I had thought I could never have such feelings again with the woman, both love and friendship. But I found them in Sarah. God help me. God help us all.
Yeah, God help us all. I'll give her a divorce, uncontested. And God bless you both.
John?
Yeah?
What will you...
The events in which we are embroiled may well cost me my life, Wolf. I decided that what little time I may have left should at least in part be spent in happiness. That's understandable, I think. I do have found a woman who is both lover and friend to me.
The female pilot?
Emma Shaw. Yeah. I'll ask you a favor, if I may. Should I die, do what you can for Michael and Annie. And Natalia and Paul, of course.
And Emma Shaw?
As with the others. I'd expect no less of you for her.
They shook hands, and John Rourke stood, leaving his drink untouched. He had made love to Emma Shaw for two reasons. He had wanted to very badly, and known that she wanted him to, and he loved her. And the self-knowledge that he had done such a thing while Sarah still lived would force him to do what had to be done and set Sarah free of him. Forever. He turned his thoughts elsewhere as he left the lounge behind, entering one of the main companionways, which would take him to his quarters on the same level. It was the best of good luck having John Thomas Rourke himself aboard the USS Paladin. Not only would Dr. Rourke be vulnerable, but Dr. Rourke's death, if he survived to take the credit for it, would doubtless advance him. The Paladin was one of the few United States warships whose onboard scientific work demanded the ongoing employment of civilian employee professionals. As a Nazi sympathizer on land in Hawaii, he was able to attend clandestine meetings, deface synagogue walls, contribute occasionally to the propaganda effort, and do little else except wait for the glorious day of liberation when troops of the new fatherland would march unmolested up from the beaches, and those who had been loyal to the party these many years would be rewarded with positions of power and influence. As a Nazi sympathizer here aboard the Paladin, he had been able to smuggle out a steady stream of naval secrets to Nazi intelligence personnel located in various ports of call around the world. But now, it was as if the old gods had selected him, chosen him because he had been loyal, rewarded his all but infinite patience. The ultimate target awaited him. And even should he die in the process of killing John Thomas Rourke, he, Elwood Brooks, would be immortalized. Like the Horst Wessel song, named after a courageous young party member in the Third Reich who had given his life for his beliefs, so would songs be sung to his memory. Elwood Brooks had whipped together a plan in a matter of hours, which other lesser men would have required months in order to prepare. To that end, he knocked on the door of the cabin belonging to Commander Emma Shaw. She opened the door. He raised the gun. John Rourke stripped away his sweater and turned on the television set. The Paladin's cable system had several channels, and he selected the one which carried nostalgia television. His mind on the film, John Rourke attacked the Lancer reproductions of the Sig Sauer P-228s. He liked these guns quite a bit, identical in every way to the originals. The original 228s among the few 9mm Parabellum pistols that he ever liked before the night of the war. In that small group of 9mm Parabellums, he also included the Sig Sauer P-226, the Taurus PT-92, the Browning High Power, the Interarms Star Firestar, The somewhat old but nevertheless outstanding Walther P-38, and Heckler & Koch's unconventional SP-89 pistol, this latter the same size as one of the HK submachine guns, but minus the buttstock, of course. As fond as he was of the SIG 228s, however, and as much as he realized how these new additions to his battery of fighting handguns would be a tremendous asset to him, nothing would ever take the place of the twin stainless Detonics Combat Masters. He had carried the little 45s, usually in their double Alessi shoulder rig, ever since the guns first became available. His first Detonics, a blued gun that he'd had metalifed by his old pal Ron Mahovsky. The little Detonics pistols had never failed him. The array of handguns John Rourke relied upon, although rarely all at once, was considerable. He had been asked often why he utilized so many guns instead of just one or possibly two. Indeed, in the days prior to the night of the war, when circumstances permitted his being armed with conventional firearms, he carried only the two Detonics Combat Master 45s and occasionally a revolver as a spare gun. Either the little Colt Lawman MK3 snubby 357 Magnum, one of the most rugged compact revolvers ever built, or, when a gun could be carried openly, as in the field, his metalifed and magna-ported Colt Python. For all the hype other calibers received, 357 Magnum was perhaps the most effective man-stopping handgun caliber there was. 44 Magnum, in proper loadings, might essentially equal it, but didn't really surpass it. He had switched over to a 44 Magnum revolver in recent times for one reason only. Personnel he encountered these days might well be wearing bullet-resistant clothing. Full-charge 180-grain 44 Magnums could penetrate that, as well as armorless sheet metal of the type used in conventional vehicles. Rourke finished cleaning both the SIG 228s, the Detonics Combat Masters, and the full-sized Scoremasters, setting to work on the two revolvers he now regularly carried, the Metalife Custom Model 629 44 Magnum and the little 38 Special Smith & Wesson Centennial. The trick to properly cleaning a Smith & Wesson revolver, if one desired smoothness of operation, was to take the extra time and trouble to remove the crane screw, then slip the crane and the cylinder out of the frame, cleaning in the area where the cylinder rotated around the crane. With ammunition leaving behind its substantial powder residue, this was extremely important. A gross accumulation of debris in this area could bind a cylinder to the point where the advancing hand was forced to work unduly hard. This, of course, could lead to mechanical difficulties. The film was ending, and John Rourke was tired. He finished seeing to his guns, then washed his hands quite vigorously in the basin. The Germans produced the lubricant Rourke used, chemically identical to the break-free CLP he'd always stocked at the retreat. He stripped, making certain there were weapons properly in reach in the event that he needed them, sitting down naked on the edge of the bed. He gave a voice command to the computer which monitored the ship's systems.
Lights out, please.
The lights went out. He lay back beneath the covers and stared into the total darkness. He felt, oddly, at peace. And tonight's sleep promised to be a good night's rest.